another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the July 8, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: across Silicon Valley, startup founders are enjoying a wave of computing credits and fielding competing offers from AI model makers racing to land new enterprise customers. On their first day in the NASDAQ 100, SpaceX's shares dropped 6.8% to $149.47, down from a peak above $200 and below the $150 price where shares began trading on June 12th. NASDAQ, S&P 500, and Dow fell 1.2%, 0.4%, and 0.2% respectively. Buyout firms face a backlog of unsold portfolio companies that is only worsening as investor concerns deepen about AI's impact on the software industry. Democratic lawmakers are seeking information from Cantor Fitzgerald about how it may have benefited on a rare earth deal from its ties with Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Americans have turned out in droves to watch the World Cup, shattering TV viewership records. Getty Images has officially called off its merger with Shutterstock about a week after the deal was dealt a blow by a UK regulator. Nestle is looking to spice up some of its products to counter the duller taste buds that can accompany GLP-1 weight loss drugs. Italy's Eni is buying a 25% stake in a Chilean lithium project owned by Energy Exploration Technologies for $225 million. Shares of Rivian lost 18% after the electric car maker disclosed stock sale plans. Now for the key articles under the worldwide section. The U.S. and Iran exchange strikes, and the Trump administration blocked Tehran's ability to sell oil legally after Tehran's recent attacks on ships, moves that threatened to unravel an interim peace deal and drive up oil prices. Trump said he would consider selling the F-35 jet fighter to Turkey, setting up a potential showdown with U.S. lawmakers. Democrats scrambled to stave off disaster for the party in the U.S. Senate race in Maine as the fallout from the new sexual assault allegations against candidate Graham Blattner intensified. An Agriculture Department official called top grocers before the 4th of July holiday to pressure them to lower beef prices, according to people familiar with the matter. The structural problem that put a Manhattan high-rise at risk of a partial collapse likely stemmed from the weight of an addition, according to the developer. allies of Senator McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, said they have talked with the hospitalized lawmaker looking to bat down rumors about his health. French far-right leader Marine Le Pen plans to run for president after an appellate court reduced a sentence that barred a campaign because of her conviction for misusing EU funds. Britain's Prince Harry lost his lawsuit against the publisher of the Daily Mail over allegations of unlawful behavior and press intrusion. The picture on today's front page takes place at an airport where President Trump is being greeted. And that caption reads, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan welcomed President Trump as he arrived Tuesday in Ankara for a NATO summit. The article, Trump's push on jets for Turkey sets up clash with Congress, by Robbie Gramer, Jared Malzin, and Yoko Kabata. Law bars the country from F-35 program for its use of Russian air defense system. Ankara, Turkey. President Trump said he would consider selling the F-35 jet fighter to Turkey, signaling his embrace of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and setting up a potential showdown with U.S. lawmakers who have long opposed such a deal. Trump spoke alongside Erdogan at the presidential complex in the Turkish capital, where he landed Tuesday for a summit of North Atlantic Treaty Organization leaders. We have a better relationship with Turkey, and Turkey has been in many ways much more loyal than other countries that we think would be loyal, Trump said when asked about the program. So yeah, it's something certainly we'd consider, he said. The U.S. and Turkey have been stuck in a years-long diplomatic impasse over weapons sales since Erdogan in 2017 approved Turkey's import of a Russian air defense system called the S-400. The move triggered American sanctions, and the first Trump administration removed Turkey from the F-35 fighter program in response. U.S. officials are concerned that the Russian air defense system could gather data about the F-35, including its radar signature, and send it to Moscow. The integration of the Russian system into NATO air defenses, along with the potential presence of Russian personnel, also raised concerns among Western defense officials. In 2020, Congress passed a law that explicitly barred the U.S. from allowing Turkey back into the F-35 program until Turkey agrees to remove all S-400 systems and commits to never acquiring them or other Russian systems that could compromise the high-end jet fighter. On Tuesday, Trump said he wanted to remove the sanctions and would make a decision about selling F-35s to Turkey, though such a move would require approval from a Congress that remains opposed to offering Ankara a way back into the program. Other articles from the front page follow. U.S. hits Iran sites, revokes oil sale licenses. Prices surge after moves which were prompted by attacks on vessels near Strait. The moves threaten to unravel an interim peace, raise oil prices. by Alexander Ward, Lara Sugelman, and Benoit Falcon. U.S. forces pounded sites along Iran's coast in fresh airstrikes on Tuesday, and the Trump administration blocked Tehran's ability to sell oil legally in a fierce response to Tehran's recent attacks on ships near the Strait of Hormuz. Iran responded with counterattacks, according to a senior U.S. official. The moves threatened to unravel an interim peace deal that took weeks to negotiate and to drive up oil prices. The attacks marked the most significant escalation since the U.S. and Iran signed a Memorandum of Understanding on June 17th to reopen the strait and wind down the war. Prior to that agreement, the two sides exchanged fire multiple times, but Tuesday's strikes were planned to be much more significant in scale in order to send a strong message to Tehran, according to the senior U.S. official. U.S. Central Command, which is overseeing the war, said the U.S. completed the strikes after hitting more than 80 targets, including air defense systems, command and control networks, anti-ship missile sites, and more than 60 Iranian small boats near the waterway. The attacks were 4 to 5 times more extensive than other strikes launched since the agreement to end the war was signed last month, the senior official said. The U.S. still considers the ceasefire in effect, the person said. CENTCOM forces remain postured and prepared to hold Iran accountable when the agreement is not adhered to or obeyed, the command said in a statement. CENTCOM didn't provide any details on Iran's retaliatory actions. Iran responded with strikes and blamed the U.S. for violating the deal. Iran's parliament speaker and chief negotiator, Mohammad Badger Ghalibaf, said on social media that the U.S.'s reinstated sanctions and fresh strikes, as well as violations of Iranian adjustments in the strait, amounted to breaches of the Memorandum of Understanding. The era of bullying and extortion is over. It leads nowhere. We don't fold, he wrote. Tehran's targeting of the vessels in the international waterway through which 20% of the world's oil used to flow was unwarranted, dangerous, and a clear violation of the ceasefire, U.S. Central Command said. Plattner crisis shows Democrats' division. By Sabrina Rodriguez, Torini Party, and Eliza Collins. Democrats are scrambling to stave off disaster in the pivotal Maine Senate race as the fallout from damaging new allegations against nominee Graham Plattner threatens to intensify simmering rifts within the party. The progressive and establishment factions of the party are already jockeying to select Plattner's replacement in Maine after prominent politicians on both sides called on the oyster farmer to drop out following allegations Monday that Plattner sexually assaulted a woman he was romantically involved with. Plattner has denied the allegations and said Monday he was taking the time to reflect on the best path forward. The jockeying comes amid an increasingly fraught nationwide battle for the party's identity ahead of November's midterm elections. Progressives have been building momentum in recent primary elections, touting the victories of several left-wing congressional candidates, including three Democratic socialists in New York and Colorado. Centrists say such candidates can't win in competitive general elections and could damage the party's chances to retake Congress. That sets the stage for a potential fight over a Plattner replacement to become the latest flashpoint between the two factions. Progressives believe Plattner's primary victory over centrist Governor Janet Mills is proof that Maine voters want a candidate who shares Plattner's populist anti-establishment message. Party leaders believe the string of controversies that imperiled Plattner's campaign show that Democrats need a more traditional, well-vetted candidate. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The Canadian who steered Europe away from the U.S. Facing threats from Trump, Carney emerges as the central figure in a project to reshape the Western Alliance. By Drew Hinshaw, Joe Parkinson, and Daniel Michaels. Mark Carney swept to power on a backlash to President Trump's talk of making Canada the 51st state, which many Americans took for mere shtick. But for the new prime minister, reading intelligence reports detailing the gravity of the crisis, it was a breaking point. In private phone conversations with Carney's predecessor, Justin Trudeau, Trump had threatened to scrap the 1902 agreement delineating their shared border. "I tear that up and your whole country unravels," Trump told Trudeau in one call, according to two people familiar with the matter. Over dinner at Mar-a-Lago, Trudeau's envoys tried to dissuade Trump from absorbing their country. When one Trump aide pointed out Canada's 41 million people would lean Democrat, the president came up with a neat solution. Just split the northern neighborhood into two states, one red, the other blue. Now, as Carney took charge in early 2025, he commissioned a sensitive review that he would discuss one-on-one with his closest aides in his office or aboard the jet officially call-signed Can Force One. How dependent was Canada on one particular country for its data storage, military hardware, payments processing, and even food? It was Carney's first crack at a riddle that would come to bedevil governments on both sides of the Atlantic. What to do when your closest ally turns into a threat? His prescription, in large part, would lay in Europe, where Carney, a former Bank of England governor, had made his past and now saw Canada's future. The Canadian banker, who never before held elected office, would emerge as the unexpected central figure in a high-stakes project to reshape the economic and military community known as the West. Since World War II, the alliance had worked like a wheel. The U.S. as the indispensable hub and the rest as spokes. Carney argued that Canada and Europe would have to build an alternative model, a dense web of connections that wouldn't overly depend on any single country. His approach contrasted to that of another influential leader, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who was encouraging Europe to double down on its relationship with Trump, whatever it took to keep America from abandoning the alliance. They represented opposing poles of a years-old debate coming to boil in Europe, with the UK, like Root, betting heavily on its special relationship with Washington. France, conversely, was eager to build up Europe's own sovereign defense base and technology, from quantum computing to AI systems held outside America. Carney would try to sway the debate without provoking the superpower that imports 3/4 of Canada's goods. In effect, a threat to make Canada America's 51st state had lighted a fuse of unintended consequences that would play out far beyond North America, as overseas allies asked themselves whether the U.S.-led alliance could truly last. The Europeans made plans to meet on February 12th in a Belgium castle built by the Knights Templar. Their plan was evolving into a delicate two-step maneuver. Root was leveraging his personal relationship with Trump to keep the U.S. engaged in NATO for as long as possible. At the same time, the Allies were trying to step back from a decades-old dependency on American technology, military power, and trade without provoking Washington. The Allies began accelerating investment in space, defense, quantum computing, and payment systems to build cloud networks, data centers, and defense systems that could function without U.S. technology. On nearly every count, Europe was far behind. This week, Root brings to the NATO summit in Ankara a catchy new slogan, the Trump Trillion. His rough estimate how much more Europe and Canada have spent on defense since the president's first term. AI giants give away computing power to attract startups, by Kate Clark, Berber Jin, and Angel Ah Young. Hans Abara, who is building an AI voice startup, has found himself on the receiving end of a big opportunity. Top artificial intelligence companies such as OpenAI, Anthropic, and others, desperate to win his business, are increasing discounts. Across Silicon Valley, startup founders like Ibarra are enjoying a wave of computing credits and fielding competing offers from AI model makers racing to land new enterprise customers. Cursor, the AI coding company bought by Elon Musk's SpaceX, offered a 75% discount through July 5th. The offers from growing AI sales armies at companies such as OpenAI and Anthropic are so rich that some early-stage startup founders say they won't need to raise money as soon as they expected, and others have been able to play AI companies off one another. Startups have received offers that in some cases amounted to more than $3 million in credits from several companies for cloud computing and tokens, the central units used to measure and charge for AI usage, founders say. That is the size of the median U.S. seed round, according to PitchBook. Alphabet's Google Cloud is giving some startups as much as $500,000 in cloud credits and early access to Gemini models. It also occasionally offers special access to DeepMind engineers, a Google spokesman said. Microsoft and Amazon Web Services also offer startups special perks. The pitched battle for business users comes as AI companies seek lasting streams of revenue. They hope that by winning startups as customers early in the life of new companies, their tools will become integral to the venture's growth over time. OpenAI and Anthropic are offering a string of promotions and one-time bonuses, even as both companies face enormous pressure to improve their margins ahead of expected initial public offerings. They also face competition from increasingly powerful open weight or free models, as well as cheaper ones, many of which were developed in China. The token deals available to founders directly correlate to the scale you can grow your product, said Abera, co-founder of Dialogus. If you're not getting this deal, you will need to raise money to buy those. Anthropic's revenue skyrocketed late last year as millions of new users tapped the company's Claude Code and Cowork software to autonomously complete a range of tasks. Claude's viral popularity helped launch the agentic AI era, in which top AI companies are increasingly focused on building tools that customers can use to complete long-running knowledge work tasks, such as coding and deep research. Leaving the front page, Boiling Belgium taunts Trump and send Americans packing. That was convincing. That unsightly 4-1 final score Monday night in Seattle cannot be blamed on a bad bounce or an isolated, unfortunate play. Sports love scapegoats, but it can't be pinned on one moment or individual. Not even a presidential appeal and FIFA's stunned last-minute reprieve of the red card suspended Folarin Balogun could tilt the action. No, the U.S. men's soccer team's loss to Belgium in the World Cup's round of 16 felt comprehensive, wholesale, convincing, personal. There were some oh no gaffes the U.S. team would surely like back, but on the whole, it was another episode showing that this country, despite its occasional burst of talent and the mighty advantage of a home crowd, continues to lag behind the game's best. Fiat's next U.S. move, a tiny EV for $14,000, by Ryan Felton. The storied Italian car brand Fiat is preparing to offer Americans an outside-the-box solution to rising new vehicle prices, with some notable concessions. Fiat, long the top-selling global brand of automaker Stellantis, said Tuesday that it has begun U.S. sales of a two-seat, fully electric compact car called the Topolino, which translates to little mouse in Italian. It is indeed very little. The Topolino weighs a little more than 1,000 pounds and about 8 feet in length. The tiny vehicle is roughly as long as the former smart cars previously sold in the U.S. Drivers even have the option of jettisoning doors for a rope to enclose them and a rope-up soft-top roof if they choose. Unlike the smart car, you won't be seeing the Topolino on the highway. The micro car can max out at 25 miles an hour, putting it in competition with a class of low-speed vehicles and upscale golf carts sold in the U.S. that don't have to meet the crashworthiness standards in place for typical passenger vehicles. The Topolino has no air conditioning system and is expected to drive up to 46 miles on a full charge. But Fiat thinks this is where it can find a niche, even in a country where big pickups and SUVs rule the road. We don't do big cars. We don't do expensive cars. We don't do luxury cars. We don't do premium, said Olivier Francois, Fiat's chief executive, in an interview. We do small. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, why did they cover for Graham Plattner? The man with the Nazi tattoo was pushed by the leading Democrats. Democrats want to fall in love with their candidates, and none more so than the supposed common man plucked from obscurity. That was Maine's Democratic Senate nominee, Graham Plattner, my kind of man, Senator Elizabeth Warren said. But long after the love died and the truth emerged, they defended him, until now when they can't. The latest is from Maine resident Jenny Rasekett, who alleges that Mr. Plattner drunkenly entered her home in 2021 after she had told him not to and raped her. Ms. Rasekett detailed his use of force and her repeated objections, shared supporting messages with Politico, and said she told an ex-boyfriend who has corroborated her account. Mr. Plattner denies the allegations. He also canceled campaign events to reflect on the best path forward. He may withdraw his candidacy before Monday's deadline, but he is reportedly negotiating to be replaced by a fellow left-winger. By rescinding endorsements and pushing out Mr. Plattner, big-name Democrats now try to salvage their chances of unseating Senator Susan Collins, but they can't say they weren't warned. Mr. Plattner's Nazi tattoo, an SS emblem he kept on his chest for 18 years, was waved away. The candidate denied having known what it meant, despite evidence he did. This guy is an authentic man, said Ruben Gallego, Democrat from Arizona. He's not anti-Semitic. And just as important, he's going to win this election. Anything to beat Ms. Collins, a centrist Republican who voted to convict President Trump after he was impeached a second time. Asked about Mr. Plattner's Nazi tattoo, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, said, "He sounds like a human being to me. Not one of those consultant-crafted politicians or, you know, one of the 340 million Americans without Nazi tattoos." The story that Mr. Plattner had entered a dark period after his tours of military duty, but was now healed. The redemption arc was used to dismiss his online post disparaging blacks, whites, rape victims, and a Purple Heart recipient who he said didn't deserve to live in 2019. In 2021, Mr. Plattner called himself a communist, but no matter. Jon Favreau, the Obama alum and host of Pod Save America, was typical. Graham Plattner isn't just our best and only chance to beat Susan Collins. He's a good, decent man who's struggled and grown. The same was said after Mr. Plattner was revealed to have sexted other women, up to six, per his campaign during his marriage, which began in late 2023. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, whose endorsement brought Mr. Plattner to the fore, called that a distraction. Senator Martin Heinrich, Democrat from New Mexico, hailed Mr. Plattner as exactly the person the Democratic Party needs to win back working people. Daniel Moreff, the lefty political strategist who recruited Mr. Plattner, said, "People do not want their candidates grown in vats." The implication was that all of this is normal, even relatable, for working class voters and veterans. That's condescending, as usual, from the left's arbiters of masculinity. In fact, Mr. Plattner polled poorly among the working class, who saw through what his college-educated base projected onto him. Contrary to the media hype, Mr. Plattner comes from an affluent family, which sent him to the fancy Hotchkiss Prep School. His oyster business has one substantial customer, a restaurant owned by his mother. The first allegations of abuse against Mr. Plattner surfaced in June. The New York Times focused on an ex-girlfriend, Lindsay Fifield, a conservative whose story it down-peddled. "Seems like a lot of nothing," Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island, said. The only one who had anything to say that seemed unsettling was a woman who works for right-wing political operations. Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, said the behavior Ms. Fifield described was wrong, but campaigned with Mr. Plattner the next day. "The people of Maine deserve a senator who is going to stand up to the billionaire class, against genocide, and for the working class," he said. Mr. Khanna said fighting harder means you show up when an ally who challenges power is under attack. They can't so easily dismiss Ms. Resacott, who says she shares Mr. Plattner's politics and hesitated to speak out for that reason. But now that a left-winger has said it, the women are safe for Democrats to believe. A few scandals ago, Mr. Plattner pivoted from the bad news by posting, "Senator Collins is bought and paid for by Benjamin Netanyahu. Look over there, the Jews." The deflection scratched the itch of the Democratic activist base, but the party knows it won't suffice now. Senator John Fetterman, Democrat from Pennsylvania, may be right that Bernie Sanders needs to apologize for pushing this predator to Democrats. But will Democrats reflect on why they bought in and kept buying despite the warnings? No, their hunt begins now for the next working class mystery hero. No more oil sanctions waiver for Iran. The regime lost that privilege by firing on the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. Memorandum of Understanding, MOU, with Iran doesn't make sense if the regime will still carry out regular attacks on commercial ships. On Tuesday, President Trump acknowledged the reality by revoking Iran's oil sanctions waiver. The Iranians fired missiles and hit three tankers including one carrying Qatari gas in the Strait of Hormuz on Monday and Tuesday. All three were near the Omani coast, where Iran's regime seeks to halt all transits. It wants commercial traffic to resume only under its control, transiting by permission and soon by toll, or not at all. The MOU says Iran will make arrangements using its best efforts for the safe passage of commercial vessels. The regime is making arrangements all right, maneuvering to control the strait, but firing unprovoked on civilian tankers is as clear a violation as it gets. The MOU negotiated by Vice President J.D. Vance and company was light on nuclear commitments and heavy on sanctions relief up front. Its redeeming feature was supposed to be reestablishing freedom of navigation in the strait while nuclear talks proceeded. Instead, the strait is under fire and nuclear talks are barely underway. The sanctions waiver was always overboard, with no safeguards to keep revenue in escrow rather than in Revolutionary Guard coffers. Already Iran has exported billions of dollars of oil, but so has everyone else, bringing down the price of oil as Mr. Trump was desperate to see. The next step to look for is a resumption in U.S. sanctions enforcement, which the MOU paused. The rules are now said to be back in force, and enforcement would restore the U.S. Treasury's credibility. When Iran last attacked commercial ships in June, Mr. Trump retaliated by striking low-value military targets. This failed to deter Iran. But the regime also failed to halt traffic through the Omani route. That's why Iran has attacked again to win the battle for Hormuz. Revoking the oil sanctions waiver suggests that perhaps Mr. Trump won't merely stand down, clinging to the husk of the MOU. It suggests the dawning of knowledge about an Iranian regime that remains a bully and whose word is worthless. Terrorism is all it knows. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, Socialism and the Decline of the Black Family. Children need fathers, but social fragmentation gives an advantage to those who seek centralized power. By Jason L. Riley. By now, it's clear that Zoran Mandani's mayoral victory in New York last year over former Governor Andrew Cuomo was less a fluke than a harbinger. Non-coastal socialists have racked up congressional primary victories against establishment Democrats in Colorado and Pennsylvania. They've won state and local contests in Kentucky and Georgia, and are on the ballot in Florida, Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. These far-left candidates aren't hiding their extremism. They want punishing taxes on the wealthy to fund free daycare, healthcare, housing, and college. Some oppose private property and prisons, while others view border security as unnecessary and racist. Conservatives are right to be concerned about the impact on our free market capitalist system if enough people with such views are elected to positions of power. But socialism's impact on the traditional family structure is no less concerning. Children from intact families are more likely to finish school and avoid poverty. The absence of fathers is strongly correlated with teen parenthood, drug addiction, and involvement with the criminal justice system. The cultural anthropologist Margaret Mead wrote that every known human society rests firmly on the learned, nurturing behavior of men, and that civilization depends upon social inventions that will make each generation of males want to nurture women and children. But socialists such as Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels dismiss the traditional family as a tool of oppression that advanced the patriarchy by exploiting the domestic labor of women. Similar thinking informs today's politicians and policymakers who want to expand the welfare state to address economic inequality. For them, nuclear families in general, and fathers in particular, were an obstacle to central planning schemes. Ultimately, the state is promoted as the best provider, and dads are seen as superfluous, if not part of the problem. The upshot is that preserving the family and its autonomy is less important to socialists than preserving their own ability to tell other people how to live their lives. One of the real-world experiments with this approach is the Black family, which has been in disarray for more than a half century and is the subject of an important new book, The Vanishing Black Family: How Welfare and Feminism Made Marriage Optional and Children Vulnerable. The author is Delano Squires, a Black husband and father, who focuses on marriage and parenthood at the Heritage Foundation. He spent more than a decade employed by the District of Columbia in a program aimed at reducing gun violence. The book offers something many others can't, which is scholarly analysis alongside the astute observations of a practitioner who has lived and worked with the people he's discussing. Mr. Squires contends that many of the social and economic problems in low-income Black communities stem from the sad fact that some 70% of Black children are born to unwed parents and nearly 45% live with a single mother. Progressives talk a lot about racial disparities in household incomes, but never seem to include family structure in their calculations, he writes. Asians are the highest earners, followed by whites, Hispanics, and Blacks. Similarly, Asians have the highest marriage rates, followed by whites, Hispanics, and Blacks. Maybe it's no coincidence. Politicians, journalists, and academics typically blame the state of the Black family on the country's history of slavery and segregation. Mr. Squires believes that ugly history has played a role, but not a decisive one. Following emancipation, one of the first things Black people did was seek out spouses and children from whom they had been forcibly separated during slavery. A project called Last Seen, Finding Families After Slavery, has compiled thousands of ads taken out in hundreds of newspapers nationwide between the 1830s and 1920s by former slaves searching for loved ones. Between 1890 and 1950, Black men and women married earlier and were more likely to be married by 35 than their white peers, Mr. Squire writes. That suggests black attitudes toward marriage and child rearing today are the product of incentives and circumstances that developed long after the end of slavery. More than 70% of black children were born to married parents in 1965, a century after the abolition of slavery, Mr. Squire writes. Today, only 30% are. This may seem counterintuitive to most people, but the facts are clear. The black family was more intact after three centuries of chattel slavery than after three generations of the federal government's war on poverty. Mr. Squire's Christian faith and deep understanding of the role that black church played in the civil rights victories of the 1950s and 60s informs his view that too many black religious leaders have since lost their way. Still, he believes that blacks, including faith leaders, not white liberals, ultimately must drive the effort to restore the black family. Socialism isn't the answer. From the editorial page, New Jersey makes a Medicaid money grab. Trenton passes a new tax on businesses with employees on Medicaid. New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill has wasted no time assimilating to Trenton's tax and spend culture. See the record $60.8 billion budget she signed last week that includes a new tax on businesses that employ Medicaid beneficiaries. Is the goal to make it harder for low-income folks to meet the program's new work requirements? Ms. Sherrill framed the tax as forcing businesses to foot the health care bills of their workers rather than taxpayers subsidizing them. The budget asks any company with 50 or more employees on Medicaid, companies like Amazon and Walmart, to cover their workers, which they should do anyway, or pay a fine, she said. Talk about misleading. Obamacare requires employers with 50 or more full-time employees to provide affordable health insurance. Yet many lower-income workers with access to employer plans sign up for Medicaid because it has no premiums. The tax will punish many employers that subsidize health coverage for workers simply because the government provides expansive coverage for free. The tax will start at $325 a year per Medicaid enrollee for employers with 50 or more beneficiaries, including a worker's dependents, and will escalate to $725 per enrollee for employers with 500 or more beneficiaries. Part-time, seasonal, temporary, and disabled workers on Medicaid will be excluded from the calculation. A 2024 state report estimated that more than 800 entities could be subject to such a tax, including many hospitals, charities, colleges, school districts, and even the State Department of Children and Families. This betrays Ms. Sherrill's deceptive sales pitch. The tax isn't a penalty on employers for not providing health care, it's a money grab. Even some left-of-center groups criticize the tax because it will discourage employers from hiring lower-income people. It could also suppress wage growth and job creation. Because the tax will take effect as federal Medicaid work requirement kicks in, some recipients might lose coverage as a result. Expect Ms. Sherrill to then blame Republicans in Washington. Democrats in California are considering a similar tax. Representative Ro Khanna and Senator Bernie Sanders have proposed requiring businesses to cover the cost of their workers' Medicaid, food stamps, and other welfare benefits. Who cares if these policies destroy jobs? The goal of today's progressives is to make more people dependent on government, not to help them become self-sufficient. The Pepper and Salt today shows a wife talking to her husband as they are looking at a pile of dishes in the sink. And she says, "Let's face it, after 3 days, it's no longer soaking, it's just not doing the dishes." Letter to the editor, Patriotic Politics and a Moderate Rebranding. After reading Tom Suozzi op-ed, "Democrats Need to Show Our Love for America, July 2nd, I couldn't help but think actions speak louder than words. Mr. Suozzi states that Democrats shouldn't let Republicans monopolize patriotism, saying that it is unfortunate that the three words of "I love America" are often exclusively associated with Republicans. The reality is that Republicans believe America is the greatest country on earth. We don't apologize for our success. We root for those who achieve the American dream, not belittle them. We honor and learn from our history, not erase it or tear it down. The problem is that Mr. Suozzi is only saying this now because he is feeling the pressure from his far left. He sees the socialist surge. He knows that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is now a leading 2028 presidential contender, and he knows that Zohran Mamdani is now the unofficial official spokesperson for the Democrats. Mr. Suozzi is scrambling to brand himself as a moderate, using America 250 and the umbrella of patriotism to distract voters from his real record, hoping they will read his words but forget his actions. When President Trump asked in his State of the Union address for lawmakers to stand, "If the first duty of government is to protect American citizens, not illegal aliens," he, along with his Democratic colleagues, remained seated. Simply put, you can't claim patriotism and a love of America, but then remain seated when it counts. From Mike LaPetri, Framingdale, New York. Mr. LaPetri is the Republican challenger facing Mr. Suozzi in this fall's election. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the July 8th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.